The Books Podcast from guardian.co.uk.
The British Library has acquired the archive of the Booker Prize-winning novelist Graham Swift. It includes handwritten manuscripts and drafts of his 8 acclaimed novels. It also includes correspondence with friends and contemporaries, and includes exchanges with his cherished angling companion, the late Ted Hughes, his English teacher at Dulwich College in the 1960s. Jamie Andrews from the British Library spoke to Graham Swift about the archive.
So Graham, welcome to the British Library.
Thank you, and perhaps I should thank everyone who's made all this possible myself.
Well, we're going to start by talking about your archive. My first question is, when did you start to think of your papers as an archive as such, as opposed to a collection of file boxes that were maybe cluttering or clogging up your study or your attic?
Well, it's obviously something which comes with age. When I set out to be a writer, I think the idea that my manuscripts and so on would become an archive would have been kind of quite dreamlike. The fact is that as you write more and more, you build up all this stuff. And, of course, you have a decision whether to keep it or not. And I have to say that I have thrown away stuff. I've sometimes thrown away stuff in a really quite aggressive way because I didn't like what I'd written. But most of it I've kept. And it just seems that there comes a point where a kind of critical mass builds up. And you say to yourself, well, what am I going to do with all this stuff? I could keep it, but the sheer volume of it starts to become a problem. So I guess I started to think of it as an archive maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and now it officially is one.
When the archive as such was in your home, how often did you go back to old material, and how actively did you sort or arrange it?
I think there were long periods where it simply gathered dust, and to be specific, most of it went up into my loft. And I don't go out into the loft very often myself. So there weren't that many occasions when I felt the urge to refer to things there. And obviously, if I did, they would have been fairly recent things. But I like to think that as I stored things away, I did so in quite an orderly fashion. I just thought, if I'm going to put this stuff out of sight, do it in a kind of careful way. Don't just shove it in a box and leave it as a mess. So it is, I suppose, as archives go, I don't know, you would know better than me, relatively orderly.
Yeah, that was my impression, actually. It was more so than that, actually, almost exceptionally ordered. I noticed in your book, Making an Elephant, there's a memoir of your father, where you talk about the way you were looking through his photograph albums and how he had carefully indexed and labelled them. Do you think that kind of ordering is something that you've got from him, perhaps?
It could be to some extent, although I have to say there's part of me which is extremely messy. And indeed, there's part of the writer in me which is extremely messy, because writing itself, I think, is a very muddled and messy and mysterious and sometimes confusing thing. And if you were to look at any average page of my manuscripts, I think you would see that straight away. They're extremely messy, quite indecipherable in some cases. I always have used pen and ink. I've always crossed out a great deal. There are lots of squiggles and lines and arrows. So in that sense, I would say I'm not at all organised.
Okay. That's interesting you mentioned that. Of course, archives, drafts are full of twists and turns and false roots. Do you ever get nostalgic for what might have been with a work, for a direction that a character or a narrative may have taken? And do you ever regret, or have you ever regretted, once you've had a novel published, that actually maybe you should have stuck with draft 7 or 6 or something?
Nothing quite as sort of solid as that. In fact, nowhere near that. I usually, by the time I finish something and I'm satisfied at that point that it's finished, that's really it. I don't often revisit my work. I just certainly don't sit down and reread it like a normal reader would. When I do that, though, I would, I think, sometimes look at a sentence and think, oh, I wish I'd written that sentence in a slightly different way. I'd be sort of dissatisfied with it in a kind of detailed sense. But as a whole, I'm usually, by the time I'm ready to part with it, quite sure that that is indeed the case. It can go out into the world now. So I haven't had big second thoughts about, you know, whole plot lines and characters, no.
And how are you sure? How do you know you've arrived at that moment when it can go out into the world? How do you know you've finished?
It's an instinctive thing. It's a sort of intuitive thing. It's partly also a process of sheer exhaustion. You feel there's nothing more I can do with it. I think all writers have, to some degree, a desire to be perfect, to write the perfect novel. And of course, that's impossible. But you strive to get close to it. And in fact, in practice, what happens is you say to yourself, well, this is the best I could do with this, and it's now ready to go.
You're talking about the striving for perfection. Do you ever find yourself in the kind of Flaubertian position of reworking a sentence or a phrase over and over again to get to that perfect form?
It can happen. Mm-hmm. I think it's entirely unpredictable. On any given day, I could, on the one hand, spend hours working on effectively a paragraph, or indeed a sentence, and at the end of that day, even having done all that work, decided it's not right. In another day, in the same space of hours, I could write several pages and be happy with those pages. And I think that is, it's one of the frustrations, of course, but it's also one of the excitements of writing, is you never know what is going to happen. Hmm. Generally speaking, I'm certainly capable of revising a great deal. I do rewrite a great deal. It's rare, even if it is joyful when it happens, that it's right first time. But most of it is hard slog.
Hmm. One thing that struck me looking at your archive was there's an awful lot of paper and ink there, and not an awful lot of typewritten or word processed, and that's becoming, I think, more and more rare with contemporary writers, where if drafts exist as a physical object, they may well be printed out with handwritten emendations, but nonetheless printed out, or they may not even exist as physical objects, they're electronic files on someone's hard drive or in the cloud. Have you ever been tempted to change your writing pattern to take account of new the kind of new technological advances in literary production, or are you resolutely sticking with pen and paper?
Well, yes, I think I am deep down and stubbornly a pen and ink person. I'm not a total Luddite. I have got a computer. I was relatively late in moving to a computer. Before that, I had various typewriters. But the actual real creative work, the kind of composition, I think it just has to be done with pen and ink. And I don't think there's been a case ever where I've sat down, as it were, at the stage where you have a blank mind and thought, what am I going to write now, and done that on the computer. I would have to do that with a piece of paper. And I think the computer is a little bit, or maybe not just a little bit, deluding, because when you see this lovely typeface coming up on the screen, it tempts you to think, oh, it's marvellous, it looks like a book already. And my rule is always at least print it out before you accept it. And I moved to the computer in the last stages, the last drafts. And of course, it's wonderful at that point, because in the old days with a typewriter, all corrections had to be laboriously dealt with, and they're very quickly dealt with on a computer. So for the final stages, it's a real boon. It speeds things up. But I won't be getting rid of my fountain pens.
It's a fountain, specifically fountain pens?
Yeah, in fact, I've written all my books with two fountain pens, one sort of packed up and one is still going, and that's always going to be the case.
See, I find that very interesting, because I can write notes on paper, but I can't write anything substantial unless it's on a screen, because I like to put random ideas up out there and then shape them. My sense has always been that if you write by hand, at least in the initial stage, you have to do a lot of writing in your head first before it comes down to the paper. Is that something you'd recognise?
That may be the case, although I'm not really aware of it. What I do feel is that the pen gets stuff from your head onto the page amazingly quickly, and it does it in a way which means something to you. I mean, when I'm writing at the manuscript stage, no one else is going to look at it. It's important that I understand it. So in using a pen, I can not only put words down, and if I want to rapidly cross them out and put alternatives and all that stuff, I can put all kinds of little squiggles and symbols in the margin very rapidly with a pen, which will mean something to me. And my fear at that stage is always that I will lose something, because my powers of mental retention certainly don't get any better. My short-term memory is not what it once was, and I'm always worried that I will lose something, whether it's something I need now or whether, as is often the case, it's a little idea I have for something coming up, and I need to make a note of it very quickly, and I think the pen is the perfect instrument for that.
So you always carry a notebook around with you wherever you go?
Oddly, no, but I've always got some sort of piece of paper on me. I'm rather against the idea of walking around with a notebook. That would make me feel too much like a kind of writer. But I'm certainly often in the position of an idea comes to me, I'm sitting on a tube train or whatever, and I have to rapidly note it. And I get out some bit of paper in my wallet or whatever and hope that I got a pen or a pencil and make a quick note of it. If I don't do that, I often find myself constructing little memory devices so that I won't let that thing go, whether it's a key word or not. That business of retaining the thing that you need to use is terribly important.
Can you remember any kind of unlikely place where the first idea or a crucial idea for one of your novels came to you?
Oddly, I think I have to say no to that. It would be marvellous to have that memory clearly, if only because, writers are often asked that very question by journalists, how did it happen? What was the first thing? And it would be nice to give them a clear answer. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. What happens, I think, is that almost without knowing it, you're aware that you have something going, you have something on your hands, you've somehow crossed a line and you're into something, even though you can't really say where that line was. And my novels certainly don't begin with grand big ideas. I think they begin with small things which grow, but they begin in a very confused way too. It's groping in the dark quite a lot.
Back to the archive again. We've just been into the manuscript stacks where all our manuscripts and archives are stored, because we wanted to show you where your papers are now going to be living. And they're living just facing the archive of Ted Hughes, which is a nice correspondence, because I believe you were friends and you knew each other and you fished together.
That's right.
For a while. How does it feel, firstly, to see up until recently was such familiar, almost banal file boxes, etc., now in a place like this? And how does it feel when you walk away from them knowing they're not coming home with you again?
Well, since you mentioned Ted Hughes's archive, which is at the moment apparently physically close to where you've put mine, I can't help feeling very touched and moved by that, because, of course, Ted is not with us anymore, and he should still be with us. He died far too young. So there is that effect it has to see his stuff. Just on my own stuff, I realise this is a rather humbling thing, that, of course, when my archive, which was, I think, 70-plus boxes of stuff, was in my house, it looked like a lot of stuff. To me, it was a lot of stuff. And of course, it represents a large portion of my life. So it's big in terms of years. when you see it here in the British Library, among all the other stuff, it looks tiny. It looks totally dwarfed. That is perhaps a not unhealthy humbling effect, to know that, delighted though I am, that the material is here. It's just one little collection among lots of big ones.
Well, I suppose the idea is that it's the connections that it makes, the fact that in your archive there are letters from Ted Hughes. You feature in Ted Hughes' archive, I believe, in his fishing diaries, and he recounts some of his fishing trips. And there must be other connections as well, that because we haven't started to catalogue your papers yet, we're not yet aware of. So does it feel both perhaps humbling in terms of size, but also that it's connecting into new networks?
Well, I think that's a very good point, and it's one I haven't really fully realised yet, that, again, when these boxes were in my house, they were, in a sense, entirely isolated. Although, of course, they contain a great many connections with other people, with other writers, letters and so on. And now those connections can be followed through. Yes, it's something which I suppose you could say is still growing in that sense.
That's it. I mean, the collections are never stable. They're constantly reevaluated as soon as the new collection comes in, because it changes the perspective and everything else, which is why it's, I think, so fascinating. Now, objects, I think, in your work, it seems to me, are an important feature for carrying meaning across generations. So, for example, the bottle of Coronation Ale, the case of Coronation Ale in Waterland, or the notebooks in Ever After, or even there's a bus ticket that you mention in one of your, or that is mentioned in one of your poems that you find by accident and that transplants you back to another time. How do you feel your objects, your archive, will be used, seen in the future? What do you expect people to do with it?
This is something I haven't thought about deeply, I have to say. Maybe I should think about it more. My first thought, I suppose, is that this material now becomes the object of scholarly research. That people now will come here when the archive is ready, from pretty well everywhere, if they wish, to go through this stuff. It's another way in which it will extend its kind of scope and, in a way, its size. I'm quite ready for that, and I'm quite happy about that, because, if only because, I have had a lot of people ask about access to things which, while all the stuff was in my house, I wouldn't be prepared to allow, but through an institution that can happen much more efficiently.
Okay, well, if we move on now to your new book, which was published on the 6th of March, and it's called Making an Elephant. The first thing I think that surprised me, looking through the contents, was that there's a series of poems which are published in here. You're not, I think it's fair to say, generally known.
I'm not known as
being
a poet.
No. How did you decide to bring these to publication? And when you wrote them, was it always the idea they'd appear in print, or was that something that you focused on later?
Well, the poems are possibly a one-off. I mean, there are several poems, but collectively they're a one-off, because I'm not a poet. I suppose there is a sense in which I believe that poetry isn't just a matter of verse, so there is poetry in prose, and if people felt there was an element of poetry in my novels, that would quite please me. But I'm not a poet in the sense of having written these specific things known as poems before. The poems in Making an Elephant all come from a rather strange period between two novels. I had finished a novel called The Light of Day, and I was, in a sense, I was just resting, but also starting to look for my next novel, which wasn't arriving. And out of a feeling of wanting to do something which would keep me fresh in this interval, I started to write some poems. I can't say why it should have happened at this particular point, but certainly what did happen is that once I'd written one poem, another one popped up, and then another one. And so for a period of several weeks, maybe months, I seemed to be writing poem after poem. And I kind of thought, well, what am I going to do with this stuff? Is this just for my own personal kind of delectation? Is it perhaps worth publishing in some way? I certainly never thought that I would actually put them into a specific slim volume of poetry. I feel that would have been rather audacious of me. But when the idea for this book, Making an Elephant, began to evolve generally, I thought, well, this is an opportunity to publish some of these poems, by no means all. So there they are.
Was the process of drafting, of composition, markedly different from that of your other work?
Of the poetry?
The poems, yeah.
Was certainly pen and ink again. And as much crossing out as with the prose, if not more. The great thing, of course, was it's fast. writing not all of the poems, but writing many of the poems is astonishingly rapid process. At least the first kind of draft, it would come in a flash, and it was a delight for me to have this quickness of composition when obviously novels are such long, laborious tasks. And I enjoyed that, and I enjoyed the sort of hopping from one poem to another. It served as a really refreshing exercise, if nothing else. But I like to think that some of the poems have some real meat to them, that they are worthy of their place in the book.
It was interesting. My sense was that although the form was unfamiliar to me in terms of your oeuvre, the themes that emerged, kind of the everyday and transcendence and historical forces, and water, still quite a lot of water in there, are themes that can be seen in your wider work as well. Is that something that you recognised while you were writing them, after?
Yes, I think I recognise the sort of things you're mentioning afterwards, and certainly when I was thinking of which ones might go into the book or not. And one thing I certainly noticed is that a number of the poems could be called narrative poems. None are very long, but there are some relatively long poems which tell a story in one way or another, and it's often effectively the story of a whole life, a very condensed story of a whole life, a whole character evolving, which of course is not a million miles from what goes on in my novels. And I've always found in my fiction that I like to explore very long periods of time, and to get a sense of a character's whole life, and whole decades going by. And one or two of the poems, I think, have that feeling.
There's one poem that struck me particular, which perhaps is slightly different from the model I was just describing. It's called Borrowers, and it plays on the word credit. And the thrust of it, I think, is incredibly prescient, given the credit crunch that seems to be enveloping us. So I guess my slightly flippant question is, you seem to have known about this all along, and did you try and tell anyone?
I don't think it was prescience. That poem, like the other poems, would have been written, in fact, a few years ago, so before what is happening now in the financial world. But I think what is happening now is only the fruit, the bad fruit, of what was going on then, which was indeed a great deal of borrowing or over-borrowing and use of credit. In the poem, in fact, it has a rather retrospective element to it, even for the time in which it is written or was written, because it looks back to a time before the credit card, to a time before easy credit, and to days in which the notion of living now and paying later was not current. It was the other way around, if anything. I'm old enough to remember such a time. I'm old enough to remember when there were no credit cards. And I've always felt they were, I have one myself, of course, but I've always felt they were rather dangerous things.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk, to finish really, by talking about place, which of course comes up in your work and your writings about your work and your describing your work a lot. And I'm struck when reading the accounts of your friends, your writer friends in this book, people like Carol Phillips, Rushdie, Ishiguro, Patrick McGrath. These are what we might call transnational writers. Whereas you hail decisively, shall we say, from South London, and I believe you've lived mostly in
still
that
there.
Area
yeah,
for your life. Do you feel yourself then to be a London writer, an English writer, a British writer? And if so, what might that mean?
I don't spend a lot of time feeling about the thinking about these kind of labels. I'm a writer, basically, and I don't think I'm this kind of writer or that kind of writer. I'm obviously, if you want to call me this, an English writer, because I'm indisputably English, and I come from London. I was born in London, I've lived in London most of my life, and this is reflected to some considerable measure in my work. It's also, incidentally, one reason why I'm glad my archive is here in London. It's just kind of up the road for me. I don't feel my sort of geographical confines actually to be particularly confining, because fortunately I know that my work is read in many parts of the world, both in its original English form, in North America, for example, and it's read in translation in all kinds of countries. So something about my work must travel, even though it may be at the same time quite English. It may have a quality that goes with where it comes from. But I hope I'm touching on some sort of universal things, some things which are true for human beings wherever they are. And in that sense, perhaps I do transcend my origins. I'm not a great traveller. I like travelling, and in fact, one way or the other, I have travelled, I suppose, a lot. But I think what I do is actually travel a lot in my head. And the travelling that a writer does is not necessarily from one country to another. It's from one character to another. And the great excitement and adventure of writing is really getting out of yourself, your own circumstances, into someone else's. And that someone else might be on the other side of the world, they might be just around the corner, but it's still the same kind of adventure, it's still the same big journey.
Talking about translation, transposition, I still haven't seen the film of Waterland, but I was surprised, shocked to find out from the book that bits of it that were set in the novel in Greenwich and London were transposed to, I think, Pennsylvania.
To Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, right.
To be precise, yes.
Yeah. How on earth did that come about? How did it affect the balance of the film? And how did you have the idea of time in Greenwich Mean Line if it was going to be in Pittsburgh?
Well, I mean, let me say, I was shocked as well at the time. I mean, the circumstances were that at that time, this was the first adaptation of a book of mine. I was not at all well versed in these things. It was in the hands of a film production company. I went away, carried on with my writing, more than half thinking that the film would never be made. And suddenly it was being made, and suddenly I was aware of all kinds of things, including the fact that a large part of the film was going to be set in America. And I literally became aware of this when I was invited to a day of shooting on location in Norfolk. And I discovered this at a point where it was obviously an absolute fait accompli. There's nothing I could do about it. The cameras were already rolling, if they were rolling in England at that time. And I don't think it would have helped anyone, and in a way, least of all me, if I'd sort of created an enormous tantrum about it. It was just a fact. It doesn't totally destroy the film. I think the best parts of the film are the parts that are set in England. And it's a very sincerely made film, and it has real strengths. Looking back, I wish I had been more involved in the adaptation process so that hopefully I could have controlled such things. Being a bit more sort of crude and materialistic about it, it had American money in it, it had an American director, they were thinking of the American market, so they thought, let's get an American angle on this film, and I dare say there were also some interesting tax breaks about shooting some scenes in Pittsburgh, so that's okay. How it happened.
Okay. One penultimate question kind of leads on from Place. It's about where real life butts against fiction and vice versa. You mentioned that novel writing, it's about making imaginative leaps and connecting with people through imagination, the characters through imagination. There's two stories I've seen recently. One was a debate that The Guardian editorialised about over whether one should be allowed to throw ashes, human ashes, in public spaces as an act of memorial. And Last Orders was brought into the narrative. And secondly, I read a writer who was travelling around Norfolk and the Fens and talked about Graham Swift's Fens. I know you don't come from that area. How does it feel when unintentionally and unimaginably your fictional creations butt up and surge up within kind of real-life narratives?
I have to say it's one of the delights and thrills of a writing life. And it's the sort of thing, again, which when I set off as a writer, I would never have imagined. I am generally a writer who I would say is non-autobiographical. I do not use my own direct experiences to turn into my novels. But there are other ways in which fact and fiction collide. And it is the case that truth is sometimes stranger than fiction, and it's also the case that I now and then bump into my fiction, as you say, within a real context, and it brings me up with a jolt, but it's a rather delightful jolt, and the feeling that my work is somehow mixed with reality is actually a very pleasing one.
My final question then, it looks towards the future. One of the great things with the archives of living writers is, of course, that the archives themselves are expanding. And so in a year or so, a year or two, we hope to be able to get the drafts of your next novel, which I believe you're working on. I just wondered, your novels have been getting more and more concise, I think. It was Ever After was a day, I guess. Last Orders was a day and Tomorrow was a night. Is the new novel continuing that direction, or is it back to the expanses of Woodland?
I think there's a limit to that process. So you have a novel which occupies a space of half an hour. The novel I'm now working on, and it's still in a fairly amorphous state, so I have to be careful what I say about it. But I don't see it as reducing the time span any further, although I think the way it might shape up is that it will have, as well as a lot of other stuff which takes place in long periods of time or long periods of memory, certain events which occur in quite a narrow period of time anyway, in this case maybe a space of 2 or 3 days. Which is actually rather longer than the night in the single night in Tomorrow. I think I seem to be drawn to that sort of duality of a narrative which is both very immediate and occupying immediate periods of hours or days, and yet at the same time is historically quite big, quite long, quite backward looking.
Do you have a title, a working title, while you're composing?
In this case, no.
But you have...
Sometimes the title has come to me quite quickly, and I've thought, well, I'm now writing this thing which has a name. Currently, I have no title. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't bother me if it isn't discovered until I've finished. I think with The Light of Day, I had a sense of that would be its title, because I had a sense that those would be the last words of the novel. That was rather peculiar. Waterland was not a title I had until after I'd finished. Last Orders came to me at some point in the course of writing, quite late in the course of writing, but it came to me as the obvious title for that book. I mean, it just leapt out at me. Peculiar things, titles.
Okay, well, whatever its title is, we look forward to welcoming it to the archive as and when. And Graham Swift, thank you very much.
Thank you.